Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight is 36 and was adopted by white Jewish parents when he was 2 weeks old. He began playing the violin at age 5, and in 1996, while still a student at the University of Michigan, founded the Sphinx Organization, which provides classical music education and competition for black and Latino students. In 2005, he received a genius grant of $500,000 from the John and Catherine MacArthur Foundation to encourage his endeavors. His name? Aaron Dworkin. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Aaron Dworkin, the founder and president of the Sphinx Organization. Aaron, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's great to be here.
Can we start by you talking about your parents and your childhood?
Sure. I originally grew up in New York City, Manhattan, and actually I was adopted when I was 2 weeks old, and my adoptive parents were white and Jewish, and in the city, and I initially grew up there. My birth father is actually African American, and my birth mother was white. And of course, I wasn't to really know that and discover them until much later in life. But I originally grew up in Manhattan, and I began playing the violin when I was 5 years old. My adoptive mother was an amateur violinist, and she was kind of really excited about a recording that she had heard of the Bach unaccompanied sonatas and partitas when I was about five, and she kind of began playing again. And I thought that, you know, it was just the coolest thing in the world. And was really interested, and so began to play.
When you were 10, your family moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and you were the only black family. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, well, and actually it was pretty tough because my adoptive parents were white, and so there was one black family in the town other than us, and basically me. So to go from Midtown Manhattan to that kind of environment was quite a stark difference for me socially and environmentally. It wasn't the easiest transition for me. And it's actually one of the things where music became such a critical part of my life because my violin playing, I was able to often, you know, kind of turn to the violin and express some of the challenges, frustrations, and things that I was going through through the violin and instead of through, you know, less productive ways.
Aaron, so many adopted children have emotional scars. What advice would you give adoptive parents and adopted children?
Wow. It's, it's interesting because there are a lot of problems with adoption. One of the things that I guess I would say is that whatever your belief is, whatever your desire is as an adoptee or as a birth parent or adoptive parents, is whatever it is that you're desiring to know or to find out, that you follow that dream, you follow that desire, that belief. Some birth parents very much want to be reunited with their children, others don't. And so I don't think there's one simple solution for everyone. But you have to take what feels right, I think, in your heart and follow that. And for me, I always felt driven since I was a teenager and younger to know, to find my birth parents. I was driven by this curiosity. I needed to know. I needed to be able to look someone in the eyes physically and see myself. And so that led to a drive that I was very, very lucky, was very supported by my adoptive family, and they always supported that process, and Lucky enough for me, in addition to that, my birth mother was also looking for me very actively, and we ended up being able to get reunited on a website of all things in the modern day and age, and it's led to an incredible reunification with not only my birth mother, but she was then married to my birth father, and I have a full sister who's now going to the University of Michigan, and they were able to meet my adoptive parents, and so it's just been really, for me, a dream come true in so many ways, and I consider myself very lucky, and unfortunately not every adoptee story, has a path like this. But I think that the best option is to follow your heart and see where it leads you.
Where was the actual reunion, and can you talk about that event?
Sure. Well, my work is of course focused around the Sphinx organization, and every year we have kind of the big competition finals for the Sphinx competition, and the meeting of my birth family and adoptive family actually occurred at the finals of Sphinx at one of our key events. So that was, of course, a very unique moment, and I think also great that in many ways it was surrounded by this music that, is my life's work. And then in terms of my actual reunion with my birth parents, which came before that, I actually went, and drove to New York where they live, and it was one of those moments that you can't really describe in words. Again, music is the kind of stuff that's written for this. It just truly was a very memorable experience, and literally got out of the car, and there were my birth mother and birth father and sister, and so it just is a tremendous experience. And one that, unless you've experienced something like that, you can never fully describe it to someone else.
When we come back, we'll ask Aaron Dworkin about the Sphinx organization. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Aaron Dworkin. Aaron, it's 1996, and you're still a student at the U of M. You decide to start the Sphinx organization. Why?
Well, one of the interesting things is that I was, I am an African-American violinist, played since I was five. And in my entire education and life as a young person growing up, I was either the only or one of less than a handful of minorities in virtually every musical situation that I was in, whether from New York City to, of course, Hershey, Pennsylvania, to the Peabody Prep, to summer programs that I was involved in, ultimately Interlochen Arts Academy. And it wasn't until I was at the University of Michigan and working on my degrees that I really began to think about that reality that I had always known, but really started to think about it in kind of a conscious way. And two really kind of transformative things occurred for me. First was that I went into a lesson one day, and I was just talking with my teacher about what pieces to work on for that semester. And my teacher, Stephen Shipps, at the professor at the School of Music, said, "Well, there is music by minority composers, if you're interested. We've got a lot of music by black composers." And I kind of just looked at him stunned. For my entire life, I never knew there was any classical music by black composers. No one had ever told me there was. No one had ever, told me to play anything. And, of course, when you're a young person, you kind of just play what your teachers tell you to play. And it just never even occurred to me that it could be possible that there were black composers, say. So my teacher started pulling just these volumes and volumes of work off his shelves and said, "Well, there's a whole library here of incredible music. Pick and choose, and let's play some of this great music." And so I was, of course, overwhelmed by this, and I ended up focusing both my undergraduate and graduate degrees on, and my solo performances on, the music of minority composers. Meanwhile, while that happened, as I began to go to classical concerts, I began to pay more attention not just to who I was seeing on stage, who, of course, very few blacks or Latinos, but then also around the hall. And so I'd be in a, you know, Hill Auditorium surrounded by 4,000 people, you know, Joshua Bell concert. I look around the audience, and less than a handful out of 4,000 people, less than a handful were minorities. And I really started wondering, why is this the case? And my personality is such to kind of not sit around and complain about things, but if you feel there's something wrong or there's something where you could, you know, help make a difference, then, you know, you get up and you try and do something. And so that's where the initial idea for, well, what about a competition? What about an organization that could address this problem of diversity in classical music? And that, it's from that idea that Sphinx was born.
What does the Sphinx organization actually do?
Well, initially, we just started as a competition, a national competition for young black and Latino string players. One of the things that I was to discover very quickly as I really began to delve more into this problem of diversity in classical music is that I realized a competition, while it could address some key areas, wasn't going to be able to solve the problem, and that very quickly, if possible, we needed to expand our programming to tackle this area at a number of different levels. And so now, 10 years later, the Sphinx organization has four main program areas. The first and kind of our largest is what we call artist development. And basically, this is all of our programming that focuses around the Sphinx competition. The Sphinx competition is a national competition for young black and Latino string players. We have two age divisions. Our junior division is under the age of 18. Our senior division is 18 to 26. And the competition culminates with two main concerts. Our honors concert, which features our junior division final laureates, and our finals concert, which takes place at Orchestra Hall in Detroit, which features our senior division top laureates, who are ages 18 to 26. During the competition, we also assemble the Sphinx Symphony, which is the professional all-black and Latino orchestra that we assemble from around the country. Nationally, about 1.5% of orchestras are black or similarly Latino. So, of course, dramatic underrepresentation. So we literally pull the one or two from many of the major orchestras around the country, gather them together as one of the top orchestras in the country, and they actually perform during the concert itself. One thing I should add, too, the honors concert actually takes place on the campus of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and this year it will be at Hill Auditorium. In addition to kind of the actual concerts of the competition, our laureates, our top winners, continue on to solo with about 30 of the top orchestras around the country, including our own Detroit Symphony here in Detroit, as part of our professional development program. They also go out into schools in all of those communities that they go into around the country to bring classical music to young people. We also have a scholarship fund, an instrument fund. So all of that focuses around the competition and is what we call artist development. Now, we have three other program areas. One is our Sphinx Preparatory Music Institute, which is a full preparatory music program based here in Detroit at Wayne State University. Students aged 11 through 17 are able to study all different instruments, whether it be strings, winds, percussion, and they also get classes in music theory and music history, including music by minority composers, so it's a fantastic program. We now have added a new program here in Detroit, our Overture program, where students are able to learn specifically violin, but actually take classes every week and are provided with instruments that they're able to take home and will then perform at the end of each semester in recital. So this is a very exciting introductory program that we're just launching this year. And there is, I believe, still some availability for these programs, and people can contact the Sphinx organization to see if there might still be room for their students or their children. Our third area of programming is the Sphinx Performance Academy. This is our summer program. It's an intensive two-week summer program based outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And their students come from all over the country to specifically study strings, and they get intensive chamber music, individual instruction, and, of course, all perform in a final recital for that program. And then finally, our Classical Connections programming, which is basically our in-school programming that we do in a number of cities around the country. So those are kind of our four main program areas. And then in addition, this year is very exciting for us because this is our 10th anniversary. And so in addition to the 10th competition, which will take place here in Detroit, the J.P. Morgan Chase Foundation has underwritten our Carnegie Gala Concert. So this year and for the next 3 years, we will be able to do our Gala Carnegie Hall Concert, which is coming up October 24th in New York City, and which will feature all of our top alumni from the competition. So we have some tremendous events going on this year, and if possible, we encourage people to attend.
We're talking to Aaron Dworkin, and I'm Jack Krasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Aaron Dworkin, who in 2003 was named a Michiganian of the Year. Aaron, you started the organization on a shoestring, and it struggled financially in its early years. What kept you going?
Well, for me, I really have no choice. This is my life's work. You know, music has been a part of my life since I was 5 years old and before. And when I look at the disparities and the lack of diversity in classical music, when I look at the inability of classical music to connect with the minority community, with young people, for me, it's really not a choice. Through, you know, a kind of miraculous set of events, my life was kind of put on this track, and in some ways I feel like I didn't really choose it. It chose me. And so when you go through those tough times, and some of them are tough in terms of identifying the resources to be able to do this work, I find that, you know, being persistent comes easy because I know this has to be done. And if we aren't doing it at this point, you know, no one else is doing it. So we must do it, and we must be successful at it. And that really keeps me going.
What has 10-plus years of building this organization taught you?
Probably more than anything else is patience. I tend to be a pretty impatient person. I like to be able to, you know, have an impact right away. And although we've done some fantastic things in these first 10 years, as I look out over the next couple of decades of Sphinx and the work that we're going to do, I think that I'm tempered with a sense of patience that there are some key additional challenges that we will overcome and achievements that we will have, but that it won't happen in a month, it won't happen in even a year or two, that when we look at what our goals are for America's orchestras and the role of classical music in the lives of young people, that we'll be successful, but that it will take some time if we're going to do it right.
How can we learn more about the Sphinx organization?
There are a couple of ways. People can always, of course, call Sphinx Organization directly at area code 313-877-9100. And again, it's 313-877-9100. And you can always go to our website at www.sphinxmusic.org.
We're talking to Aaron Dworkin. When we come back, we'll ask him about being named recently by Newsweek magazine one of the 15 people who make America great. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Aaron Dworkin, who was just named by Newsweek magazine one of the 15 people who make America great. As an aside, another one of the 15 was Brad Pitt. Congratulations. What was that like?
Well, it was obviously an incredible, incredible honor, and very humbling to be in, a league with some very, very well-known people. But for me, what really was most important is that there is this awareness and visibility for the work that we're doing.
What does playing an instrument do for a child?
Oh, it literally can change a child's life. Whether it's a string instrument, whether it's a wind instrument, when a child is able to make music and convey the experiences of their life through that instrument, it can be transforming, not only for them, but for the audiences for whom they're able to play. And so one of the things that we have found is that those of our students who are able to practice and continue playing on their instruments, it literally is able to transform not only how they're actually playing, but so many other areas of their life. So there is this kind of enrichment of life, this quality of life that can be completely transformative for a young person. But outside of that, outside of what we feel is the real role of music, which is that enrichment, that quality of life, there's also the pragmatic benefits of studying a classical instrument. There's the countless studies that have shown the correlation between the impact of an early study on a musical instrument and how that ties into math, to science, to other academic testing, to discipline, to goal setting. So when you look at all of these measures of student academic achievement, of youth development, the involvement of classical music at an early age is critical to the benefit of our young people, and of course, most importantly, can be truly transformative.
What advice would you give to a young musician who's being made fun of by his or her peers for playing an instrument?
You know, it can be a tough thing. I believe it's less than it was when I was younger, and I've got some stories to tell for sure. And in addition to being teased, one of the things that I faced as a young African-American violinist was I was a concertmaster of my youth orchestra. And there were times when I would go, and as the concertmaster at the beginning of a rehearsal, you stand up and you tune the orchestra. You get the A from the oboe and you tune the orchestra. And the orchestra would refuse to quiet down so that I could tune the orchestra. And this was, of course, as a young person, a very traumatic experience. And the advice that I would have and what I ended up doing was focusing on the music itself and what I knew I wanted to do. My whole life, you know, people have tried to, you know, define me and put me in boxes. Are you either black or are you white? Are you a musician? Are you someone who likes classical music, or are you someone who likes rap? Are you someone who likes, you know, hip-hop? Or are you someone who likes country? You know, people feel a need to put people in boxes so that you can kind of be easily explained. And the reality is that as people, we're far more complicated than that. And I think that all too often young people let themselves be molded into these boxes because of peer pressure, because someone might tease you. And so I would say to young people, you know, someone says, oh, look, you're carrying a violin. Say, yeah, you want to hear it? It's pretty cool. Or talk to them about the fact that, well, you like Alicia Keys? You know, Alicia Keys started out with class standard formal classical music training. Tupac went to the Baltimore School for the Arts and originally had classical style training in that type of environment. So when you start connecting and you tell them, well, you know what? People who we actually admire, the people who we like and their music and what's really cool, this is how you get there. This is how you develop those skills. So what I'm doing is actually pretty cool. If you like it, cool. But if not, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Your teasing isn't going to change me at all. I'll write you, when I get successful one day. So I think it's important to stay true to following through with your development on your instrument, regardless of whether you get teased or not. And I believe if you stay true to that, what you'll find is the opposite happens. And who knows, one day you might end up, in a magazine on a page next to Brad Pitt. So
I might be.
It isn't too bad for a violinist.
I might be aging myself, but do you think Country Joe and the Fish ever practice classical music?
I'm sure.
How does a young performer apply to enter the Sphinx competition?
Well, it's a relatively easy process. You can visit our website or write us for the applicant information. The applicant information actually has on it required repertoire that needs to be played in the different levels of the competition. The competition starts out with a preliminary round. During that preliminary round, an applicant will prepare a tape which has its required repertoire on it, and then they'll submit that tape along with a list of their repertoire performed, their teacher, other supplementary information. Those initial preliminary tapes are then reviewed by our screening committee. Our screening committee includes members of the faculty of the University of Michigan, members of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and they review those tapes anonymously, and from those tapes, they will select 18 semifinalists, 9 semifinalists in each division, 9 in our junior division, 9 in our senior division. And then those 18 semifinalists actually travel to Southeast Michigan here this February for the final rounds of the competition. And then those rounds will result in 3 laureates in each division, the top 3 for each division, and then they will compete amongst the 3 of themselves performing with the Sphinx Symphony at our 2 major concerts that occur between February 7th and February 11th.
What separates a good musician from a great musician?
Well, that's a great question. There's kind of the old adage about, you know, the difference between mediocrity and excellence is attention to detail. And I believe that it really comes down to that. For example, you could practice a piece and you can get up pretty well and play, and you might give a good performance and be a good musician. But if you spend that extra time, that extra focus, the extra hour a day, which over the course of a year leads to tremendous amounts, additional amounts of work that others might apply towards it, that is where the difference that I believe really results in excellence and greatness. When you look at those who rise to that level, the Tiger Woods, say, of musicians, you find almost without exception that when everyone else stops practicing, they stay just a little bit longer. When we see that there's practice time allocated for semifinalists, say it's an hour, and then you see those that just spend an extra 10 minutes, they typically will be the ones who might end up excelling in that particular scenario because they went the extra distance. They decided to take that step to separate themselves, if you will, from mediocrity, from what is good, and to try to advance to what is great. And oftentimes, it's a very minimal or incremental step when it occurs. But if you do that every day of your life, then the difference that you've applied towards something is vastly greater than others. So if you say, for example, say the average musician, young person coming up may spend 2 hours a day practicing, and you just spend an extra half hour a day. Now, right off the bat, you're practicing 2.5 hours more every week, over 100 hours a year more than the rest of the musicians that you might be competing with. And that can certainly bring about a difference between good and great. So I would say add that little bit of component, have the additional attention to detail, and if you do that, on a consistent basis, it's inevitable that you will reach a level of excellence and transition from being good to great.
We're talking to Aaron Dworkin, who in the fall of 2005 received a genius grant of $500,000 from the John and Catherine MacArthur Foundation to encourage his endeavors. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Aaron Dworkin. Aaron, you've always been unique. You've always walked to the tune of a different drummer. You've always taken the road less traveled. You dream very big. Talk about that. What advice do you give our listeners tonight about dreaming big?
I would say that nothing should limit what you dream about. It has, you know, kind of been a driving force for me ever since I was a, you know, ever since I can remember, really. I didn't watch very much TV when I was a kid. My parents discouraged it very heavily. And so I read a lot. And so by reading a lot, it kind of built this very, very vivid imagination for me. I would just constantly imagine things and think about things and dream about what if I was, you know, the world's greatest soloist? What if I went out and won the Tchaikovsky competition and, you know, brought nations together through my music? And, you know, I think there is no greater thing than to dream. And to make sure that you always dream, whether you are able to make those dreams a reality. But then, when you wake up and when you're going about your day-to-day business, that you let the realism of life be informed and driven by your dreams. So that if you say, okay, you know, this, I want to do this, I want to be the, you know, Tiger Woods, I want to be Yo-Yo Ma, I want to be Itzhak Perlman, I want to be, the one of the Williams sisters, whatever your role models are, whatever your dreams are, you go for them, but then you do it with realism so that you know, okay, yes, I want to be the greatest tennis player that ever lived. But you have to know that that takes practice and hard work. And then you go about the work to make that dream actually a reality. And there are no shortcuts to dreams. And you can't just dream something and then have it be a reality. You have to put in that work. So I would say make sure you dream the big dreams. Don't in any way cut back on them. But recognize the work that will have to go into it to make that dream a reality. And then let the dream be the motivator, the driving force. But make sure you follow through every day.
Can we also dream to be a Detroit Tiger, Aaron?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you say to a listener who says, I feel like I'm a victim. I feel powerless. I have the wrong color skin. I'm from the wrong side of the tracks. I'm not educated. I don't have a sense of hope.
And perhaps because of some of the obstacles that I've had to overcome, and when I talk with all of our young people involved with Sphinx, I tell them not to complain. You know, don't focus on all the reasons why you shouldn't be able to do something. Because if you do that, you'll never accomplish it. If all you focus on is the reasons why you can't do something, you will never be able to do it. You cannot do it. That's true. You will make a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if instead you focus on, well, how can I do it? What can I do? Then inevitably, the eventual result will be success. So I would say don't focus on those things. And there are obstacles in the world, but the reality is everyone has obstacles. So if you say, yes, you know, we have these racial barriers, cultural barriers in our country. There is a reality there. There is a historical context in our country. But if that's what you're going to focus on, then how is that going to limit your potential achievements? And what I also tell a lot of our young people is, yes, but you know what? I guarantee you, I can find you someone who's got a whole lot more obstacles than you do. And when I do, and I show you how motivated they are, and I show you their accomplishments, how are you going to feel? So don't focus on these things, because there are people who are struggling more than you. There are people who have had greater obstacles but have achieved more than you. Let that be your goal. Let that be your driving force. Let your role models be, you know, Mahatma Gandhi. Let your role model be Martin Luther King. Let that be your role model. And look at the challenges that they had. Look at how many years, that people have spent in prison or under oppression and have still been victorious in their goals. And let that be your guide. Let that be your role model, and not the fact that you weren't able to get this, or that someone might have teased you, or that someone didn't let you tune the orchestra. Sure, know that happens. Understand it for what it is, but then move on and focus on your own achievements.
A while ago, we had Dennis Archer on, former mayor of Detroit, and he talked about the browning of America, the fact that by 2052, the majority of Americans will be black, Hispanic, and/or Oriental. What are your thoughts on how we come as a country together, all races and ethnicities?
It's critical, and I think that Sphinx plays a role in this. We must learn to be tolerant of each other's cultures and understanding of them, and ideally celebratory of those different cultures. It is what makes America unique across the world. And many other countries look to us to see how we do it, and ideally hold it up as an example for their cultures as they begin to diversify. But unless we're able to do that, unless we're able to understand each other's differences, to live with one another, not just out of respect, but also out of love for one another, then we will not successfully make this transition, as Dennis Archer says correctly, this, you know, the browning of America and this changing demographics, which already is the reality in many of our major cities.
I read recently where you've said that you actually get inspired by obstacles. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of my personality, but it's, I have a tendency, say if I'm playing a competitive game of sports or anything like that, I tend to, and I think a lot of people tend to play around the level of the person they're playing, but slightly above. And so the greater the challenge, the more I enjoy the experience, because the more it pushes me. So if I'm going to go and, say, play racquetball with someone, I'd rather play with, you know, the world's greatest racquetball champion and continually lose, because I will learn so much more from that than by winning. And so when I look at some of the obstacles with Sphinx and other things I've come across in my life, the greater the obstacle, the more I kind of, if you will, get revved up. We've got this huge funding obstacle. There's no way we're going to get this program off the ground unless we get it funding. It's a major thing. Okay, how do we do that? How we go about doing that? And I get charged up by that. I get revved up. And ultimately, it's because of the impact and the lives of our young people that I know are often counting on us to be able to help them develop their musical careers.
What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think that in the end, it is that whatever it is that you choose to do, never give up and never accept failure or setbacks. Continue to believe in whatever that dream is that you had as a child. Hold on to it and continue to be persistent. And if you do that, success is inevitable. No matter how long it takes, it's inevitable. And don't let yourself settle for mediocrity or for letting your dream go.
Aaron, thanks very much for sharing your amazing and inspiring story. Your enthusiasm is contagious.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest next Sunday will be the chairman and CEO of Wallbridge Aldinger, John Ricolta Jr. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything truly is possible. Spoken.